Thank you. Okay, so remember, Jerry had these definitions. If you remember, kindness is really like this internal attitude, this internal sense from the Holy Spirit towards others. And then the goodness is actually doing stuff about it, taking actions that would be the best for those other people, whether or not they ask for it or not, or deserve it or not, or even like it. Right? So not a natural. We discussed, this is not like a personality thing. Because some people are just, you know,
kind of.
I mean, if you don't like my wife, I don't even know what's wrong with you, because, you know, she's just so sweet and likable, it's impossible to dislike her. There are a few people who do, but I don't know what's wrong with them. But we're not talking about personality, right? Or natural. This is unnatural, because Jesus even said, love your enemies, right? Which is crazy. On the face of it, is crazy. Who does that? So, because it's God working through you to be devoted, to care about those other people and do what's best for them. And we looked at a number of verses, and then we wound up at the end looking at here, this really fascinating verse here in Ephesians 2, you know, that God has prepared good works for us to do in advance, you know, and Jerry talks about how, you know, that's all part of his design, right? You don't even take credit for those, you know, but he's prepared, you know, part of the purpose of salvation is to do these things, okay? Right, he's predestined that for us, right? And that we walk in them. They're an everyday routine. So it's not just a mountaintop, really cool ministry thing you did 5 years ago. It's every day, all the time, routine, normal. It's just part of your thing that you're thinking of. When you go somewhere, you're thinking about the other people. You know, it's just the way we walk. Okay.
Well, we should still go to Mexico and build churches and schools.
Sure. It's not, it doesn't negate the big ministry stuff. It's the balance. That's a good point. Yeah, it's not negating, you know, someone does some cool ministry stuff. Great. That's awesome. And I'll support them, and that's great. But this is every day, all the time, right? It's just, it's the way of life. It's, you're known by that, right? So then the next section that Jerry has in the book is he's talking about doing good at work, okay? And I think this is particularly a topic that's very apropos and useful in our current culture. This Christian concept of vocation, that's a Christian term actually, not just having a job, but having a vocation. I will recommend, no offense to Jerry, I'll recommend a different book here by my man Timmy, called Every Good Endeavor. This is the best book I've read on Christian and their work, where he's surveying many years of Christian thought and teaching about vocation and work, and kind of summarizes it up. And so Timmy's main audience was New York City. So he's a head. He was the head pastor at a Presbyterian church in New York City. So very educated, cosmopolitan, you know, and often postmodernist audience. But he's explaining really about, you know, the Christian calling for work is way higher than the world's calling, right? Why do people have a job in the world usually?
Make money.
Make money.
Stuff and status.
Yeah. Make money. Or it's their identity. I'm a. How many times do dudes talk to each other and, oh, I'm a plumber. Oh, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a scientist, I'm a whatever. At my work. It's people's identities. I'm a poet, I'm a this, I'm a that. Well, at some point you're going to retire and then you're not that anymore.
Yeah.
And then what are you?
Mm-hmm. Well, some of them crumble.
Yeah.
It's pathetic. Like 2 years later, they're dead. I don't mean they're dead. They're dead.
Literally.
I think they just have no meaning, you know. That is sad if that's your, because, you know, 5 minutes after I retire, they ain't going to remember me. Nobody's going to read my papers. Nobody's going to.
I will. I'll read your
Nobody
papers.
Reads them now. I mean, ten people in the world are really interested in them, but, you know, I mean.
Because he does Google Analytics on it, he knows.
Yeah. It's just, that's sad.
To an end.
That's sad. Mm-hmm. That's their identity. And that's why a lot of people work nowadays, because they don't have something else to hang their hat on, or it's achievement, or they feel better about themselves, or whatever, right? But the Christian calling is so vastly higher and great. Page 197, Jerry says, has a really great sentence in there, but he says, we should think of our vocation, and he uses that word, I believe, very intentionally, not just a job. We should think of our vocation, therefore, not as a necessary evil to pay the bills, nor even as an opportunity to become rich, but as the primary path of our Christian walk wherein God has planned good deeds for us to do. Sure. You think of your work like that? When you're working, it's like 40 hours a week at least. That's about half the time you're awake. In other words, that's a lot of your life. Most of your life. Right? If that's just over here, and then Jesus is over here, what do you do? That means most of your waking life is Jesus is irrelevant to. Okay, well that's not what the Bible's plan is. You know, that's not you know, Christian calling vocation has always been. It's very, you know, it's very meaningful what you do, and God is not an accident. The talent that you have, the interests that you have, the experience and the history that you have, none of those are an accident. You've been prepared for a particular reason to do that. And Christianity was very unique when it came about compared to other viewpoints, okay, especially 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, where Christians were like, oh, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, the mayor of the city or the janitor. It's all valuable. Okay. A lot of people assume that idea nowadays. They think they got it. I don't know where they think they got it, but they got it from Christianity. They may not know, but that's where that idea came from. That's a very Christian idea. Because before that, that was not the idea. The mayor was way more important. So.
Society-wise, we've always got that heroes going on stuff. There's first responders and military. Everybody's got to be some kind of a hero of some sort to count. And that's always kind of frustrated me because I believe everybody is a spoke in this wheel. You know,
they are. All the vocations, if that's your calling. Now, some callings, obviously, you know, drug dealer's not a, right, okay, so.
Retired realtor.
Is that a calling?
Retired realtor's lives
matter.
Retired realtor's lives matter.
You can't do something immoral for Jesus, but you can do, you know, you could be a janitor for Jesus. You could be a whatever, a dentist. You could be a whatever, you know, and they're not, you know, it's a different value.
But the reality is we need a janitor. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We need
a if somebody doesn't clean that building, it's going to get nasty. I mean, and then nobody else can do their work.
The thing is, when you see that person, are you appreciative?
You definitely
to
need
that
a plumber.
Person?
Yes.
If you don't have a plumber, you're going to notice really fast. And it's going to get ugly. It's very important, you know. Now, you've probably heard of the Protestant work ethic, right?
The what?
The Protestant work ethic.
Don't think so.
Really? Okay. So it was in literature for, well, most of American history, very large. There's a reason why you don't hear about the Protestant work ethic anymore, right? Because we're in the post-Christian, postmodernist, you know, progressive society now. They don't value those things. But for many years, it was just common thought in American society that, hey, if you got a job, you go do a good job. The Protestant work ethic. Again, and they called it, even secular people called it the Protestant work ethic because they realized that's where it came from, right? That you should do your best, right? Because the Bible teaches you don't do your best because you're making a pile of money or your boss is watching. You do your best because God put you there. It doesn't matter, right? So there's no accident that that's lost nowadays a lot, okay? And Tim points out in his book, you know, work existed before the fall. Work is not a product of the fall. Okay, many other worldviews consider work just this negative thing you just got to do. Grunge it out. Christianity work is not like that. It existed before the fall, right? They were gardeners.
God gave them a job.
Now, work is frustrated by the fall, and it's difficult now, and we have to deal with weeds and bugs and idiots, and there's a lot of challenges in work now. It's very frustrating, like everything is marred. But work itself, creativity, right? God loves that. He's so creative. There's 40,000 species of beetles. Why do you need 40,000 species of beetles? God's very creative. He loves creation and he loves that, and he enjoyed the work he did. And when we work and do things like that, it's pleasing to him. He enjoys that. I think we're going to work in heaven. I think we're all going to have a job.
Yeah, I believe that.
And we're going to enjoy it. And it's going to be great because it won't be frustrated by all the sin and garbage here.
And maybe I think we'll know the reason for those 40,000 species.
Maybe. Somebody will catalog them. But, you know, it's going to be, you know, but work is pre-fall. Work is...
Well, somebody obviously, you know, already did, or we wouldn't know there's 40,000
yeah,
species.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. A lot of them. They're cool. But, so it's really, you know, a very high viewpoint, I should say. And Jerry talks about how, you know, we should view that as when we're working, that's our location we've been placed where we can do kindness and goodness. Those co-workers, right?
Can I put in a shameless plug for the men's group? So we're skipping this Monday, but the Monday after and the next four, the following four Mondays, we're going to discuss work and education and patience.
It's an important thing. And, Christianity is super relevant to your work. It's not an irrelevant thing, and they're not completely separate. Not at all. And Jerry talks about how it's also a Christian idea that the secular, right, is not radically distinct from ministry. In other words, it's not like, you know, oh, well, the pastor's job is way up here and your job is down here because you're just a secretary or something. It's not like that. Everybody's called to their vocation. Mm-hmm. And people who do full-time ministry, that's great. That's awesome, and we should support them, and that's good. But if you're not doing full-time ministry, you're not second string. You have ministry where you are. There is ministry everywhere. People are in desperate need of Jesus. If you just open your eyes and look around, there's ministry everywhere to do. So,
start with our family.
Yeah. Yeah, it starts and goes everywhere. So the idea that secular vocations are much less valued, that's not biblical. We see that in some areas, but, you know, well, the priest is up here. And yeah, No. You should see where you're placed and go where you're placed and do great. And I try to do an excellent job at my work, as best I can to be excellent, which is harder than just being okay. I try to be excellent, but at the same time, try not to do that to get awards or to get respected or to get, you know, just do it to represent Jesus. It's difficult. Well, it's difficult for me to do that, you know, to be completely independent of whatever the result is and just do the best.
Where your heart is, what your boss sees, is excellent work, and you need to be recognized for that so that others would follow suit. But it's where your heart is. I'm doing it because I'm worshiping God, not because I'm seeking man's approval.
Right. Because, and you don't always get it.
Right.
You get ignored a lot. But Jesus talks about, yeah, you do your excellence all the time because you're representing Jesus. And then when you get to share the gospel with somebody, you have more credibility. Because like, oh, why am I listening to you? You're a slacker. You know, because other people depend on me at my job. That's why I'm there. Yeah. So, You know, it's part of the witness. Okay, a number of verses he has in his next section where he talks about doing good at home. First one's Galatians 6. I think I gave that to somebody. Good.
6:9-10. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers.
Right. So he says, do good to all people. And then he says, but especially to the family of believers. Why would he say that? Are believers more important than non-believers? Why would he say that?
It's a bigger family. It's the bigger family. It provides unity.
Promotes unity, yep.
Which attend to the orphan and widow and take care of them.
A part of worship is daily walk. Part of worship is edifying your brother and sister, so encouraging, lifting them up. I mean, that's why I would do it, fellow believers. It's part of your daily
work.
It's our family.
It is. It's our community. Yeah.
David Jeremiah says, if we do not show love to the body of Christ, we do not truly have the love of God in our hearts.
They're directly connected.
Mm-hmm. And it's the church. Christ died for the church. And the church is the bride of Christ.
So obviously he cares about them. And if you follow Jesus, you should care about what he cares about. It's not because believers are more valuable. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, if you're busy doing good, right, but you're not doing it to your fellow believers, then that discredits when you share the gospel. Because they're always watching, you know. If people come to our church and are members here, and we're not taking good care of them, what do we look like? Who wants to join that? You know? So, it's not like you ignore non-believers. You don't. You do good to them too. But you, especially the believers, you got to take care of them. Because that's supposed to be in your family. And now, when you share the gospel, you have way more credibility. Because they hear these stories of, oh, this person, this happened to him, and this happened to him, and the church all took care of him. And, right? That really... It's great advertisement. I don't mean that, and you know, Jesus doesn't need an advertisement, but you know what I mean.
It's attractive.
It's attractive.
External attraction.
Yes. Right.
It helps other people also dig in and serve more. I mean,
it's encouraging.
They feel loved and cared for and part of a body, and so then they go on to.
And how many people had that experience where the church all got around them and helped them out, and now they're like, "Oh yeah, I'll sign up. I'll bring that person a meal, or I'll do that. I'll do that." Because they saw, wow, that was really valuable.
What you receive, you want to give.
Yeah. Go back to the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to look in there a little bit more in Matthew 5. Somebody has that.
You have heard the law that says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. In that way, you'll be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. For he gives his sunlight to both the evil and the good. And he sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. If you love only those who love you, what reward is there for that? Even corrupt tax collectors do that much. If you are kind only to your friends, how are you different from anyone else? Even pagans do that. But you are to be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect.
Ouch, Jesus. Right in the...
I love the way the Bible classifies tax collectors.
Yeah. In that system, they were very corrupt. We won't talk about the IRS here, but that system was very corrupt. But wow, he just kind of, right? I think a lot of listeners at that point were like, really? Come on, Jesus. What do you... Love your enemies? Come on. How can he say something like that? That's crazy, huh?
Well, if you love your enemies, eventually they won't be your enemies.
Maybe. Or they might still hate you.
They might, but
there's some serious jerks out there.
It's a little hard to love Biden.
Yeah.
I don't really know him, though.
Yeah.
I think in context, they're under Roman rule. There's this expectation of Christ, the Messiah, in a military sense.
Yes.
Social, political. And I think he's also clarifying, hey, y'all, we're not about that.
Right. And you remember the love, that's doing what's divinely best for them. Doesn't mean you necessarily feel warm fuzzies and hug them and whatever. They may stay your enemy, but you're still doing what's best for them. You know, divinely best.
Jesus wants us to be set apart, just like he did for the Israelites. That's why they circumcised and had a special diet. Mm-hmm. And he wants his followers to be set apart. So if you love your enemies, who loves their enemy? No one else. So it's setting us apart and showing kindness, appreciation, whether you enjoy being with them or they like you, you're respecting them in a way that Jesus does.
Right. And loving the difficult people. That's not normal. Most people just kind of back off and let the difficult people leave them over here. Right? But you can win a witness by loving those difficult people. Loving those people who are not kind to you. You know, again, this is very unnatural, very 180, very non-normal human nature here that Jesus is talking about. So you have to do it with the Holy Spirit. You have to do it with the right view that you're doing this for God. You're not doing this for the other person. And you don't do it based on what the other person responds. I know, that's not easy at all. Not easy. But that's what we're called to do, because that wins people over. Yeah.
That's why it's so impactful. It's so impactful because it can only be done through the Spirit of the Lord in the right way. And so that impacts people, because wherever the Spirit is, you cannot be.
And has. There's so many stories of people doing that. And, you know, I mean, Elizabeth Elliot, right? I mean, they killed her husband. And then she went back and did ministry with that tribe for like 3 years. I mean, who does that? They killed her husband and all his friends. That's crazy, right? But she won them over, right? Last one's in Timothy. What does he say here in Timothy?
I got that one. Anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever.
Well, that sounds harsh, doesn't it? It's pretty intense there, Paul. Why is he punching so hard there? Worse than an unbeliever. Wow. What? Why does he come off that intense, do you think? Right? Because again, he's talking about believers being discredited, right? Because they're not taking care of the people that are placed in their life, but then they're preaching about how much they love everybody.
Love.
Yeah, so that's why he was making his intense point there. You know, Paul's a very careful thinker and writer. He's not going to come out with a really intense statement like that unless he has a reason for it, right?
And it's not just the church, like a fellowship church. I mean, we deal with this kind of stuff at Restore. It's just teaching priorities and values from the elementary level on up, you know. Getting back to basics.
Right. So there's a blending here. We should serve the community and needs in the community. You know, but we definitely do not neglect our own family, either our family, spiritual family, or our personal family. We don't neglect them to go out there.
There'd be a lot fewer people in nursing homes if we took care of our own family.
Yeah. Amen.
Yeah, and all of this whole chapter is about widows and the whole situation concerning how they're being cared for and even what they're supposed to be doing. So,
yeah, and that society, those were the people who had no way to support themselves. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, you got to step up, do that, you know.
And he doesn't put any qualifications, like, take care of your mother-in-law, only if she's nice to you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, who wants to bring your mother-in-law in? No offense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
For the record, I do.
Yeah, that's true, father-in-law.
I'll take the fifth on that one, but, you know. On page 200, there's this little indented section here. Somebody's got their book. Can they read that little indented little paragraph?
201 for us.
Oh, is it?
For this book.
Are you talking about true goodness?
Yep.
So true goodness is not merely impulsive, but rational and considerate. It will therefore pause and be at some trouble to inquire what service and how best may it be rendered. Goodness should be willing to give time and thought and patience and even labor, not mere money and kind words and compassionate looks.
That's our culture, man.
Yes.
Money
is. Zing. So, I had a predecessor who used to do my job at work, and they used to say, you know, do random acts of kindness all the time. And I know what she meant by that. It's kind of nice, but I think that's dumb. Kind of should, it shouldn't be random. It should be quite thoughtful. You should be noticing people around you and do careful, thoughtful, planned acts of kindness, not random. Mm-hmm. Right? I know what they mean. I'm not dissing them.
Unexpected.
Yeah.
Not prepared for it.
But... You know, he's talking about, you know, again, this should be the way we walk, what we're known for. Classic for us. Standard for us. You know, that we're thinking about it all the time. And we're willing to, that one's willing to give time and thought and labor. Willing to do that. It's going to cost something. Mm-hmm. You know, willing to listen to that person at work. It costs you something.
Running a car, driving, people being jerks.
Yeah. It costs you something. So, you know. Bottom of the page, he has an even harder hitting sentence where he says, we will always be too busy to help others unless we truly grasp the importance God puts on our doing good deeds for others. Mm-hmm. Ouchies. You say you're too busy. What you're really revealing when you say you're too busy for something is you're revealing your priorities. Mm-hmm. What's the priority?
Me.
Sorry. Yeah. Now, if you're too busy to, you know, watch Netflix or something, that's probably okay. But if you're too busy to serve in any ministry, I would argue your priorities are in the wrong spot. You know, we're all ministers. Believers are all, every believer is a ministry, is a minister. Every believer should have a ministry. Because again, you have unique experiences. You have unique interests. Unique passions. Some of you, there's some people group that you really, you know, care about a lot, you know. Like my wife, I mean, we went on vacation to Mexico. And then we went to a little water park. And what was she doing after we got there? Talking to a kid, right? She found some kid to talk to. I was like, that's her, right? That's her thing. That's, you know, some people just have this people group that you just really... passionate about, and that's good, you know, it's not an accident. And so all of us have a ministry, not the same ministry, but all of us, there should be a ministry that you're involved in a lot. And if you don't know what ministry you should be involved in, then try some, right, and find out. But everybody should have some ministry that they're really involved in. I like that our church has a statement that, you know, that CF and the elders aren't the ministers, and we support them. They're the trainers. And we go do the ministry, you know, and I think that's definitely the right approach. They're like the coaches. We're supposed to be out on the field doing the ministry, you know. Everybody a different one.
I remember Monty Robinson used to say that the church, at the end of every church service, we should have people fighting over who's going to clean the church and lock up, and, you know.
Yeah.
But we are all too busy. We all skedaddle, you know.
Yeah. Well, he's right. Yeah, it should, you know. One of Monty's favorite verses he likes to quote is slave of all. Christians are slave of all. And he'll point out slave meant slave. You know, he meant the guy at the bottom, you know. That's Jesus's, again, his 180, you know. We should be serving, you know, everybody should have a ministry that they really care about and they're really passionate about and they're really well equipped for because of your unique, you know, experiences and things. And kids ministry is not really my thing, you know.
Snow cone ministry is.
I can help out when they need it, yeah, but kids ministry is not really my thing, you know. But I have a lot of connection and a lot of, you know, feel for college students. Some people find college students really annoying. Okay, that's fine. You know, I kind of get them, and that's my thing. Great. You know, and everybody needs their own different ministry, whatever it is, you know. Shouldn't be too busy for that. That should be an integrated part of life, you know. And you might have to cut some of the other Astros games or whatever. Craig's not here. I can, whatever, you know, you can cut some of that other stuff, you know. And I'm not saying having some fun is bad. It's definitely not. But, and everybody determines their own balance. I'm not going to go around and I'm not your judge and everything. But everybody's got to find that own balance of, certainly most Americans are drastically over-entertained and spend almost all their time, energy, and money on entertaining themselves. Or amusing, okay. Well, it's interesting, amusement, right? You know what that word means? Amuse. Muse means to think. A is negation. Amusement means don't think.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
okay.
Yes.
What?
Thinking. Yes. So if you're totally used to amusement constantly all the time, you stop being a good critical thinker, and yeah, explains a lot. So,
yeah, it's really interesting when they, because it goes along with that, when they track like brain waves for versus active entertainment versus passive entertainment. It is amusing.
Yeah. No. And again, entertainment, you know, with your family, this is good, but you shouldn't be out there, you know, yeah, on your boat doing all that stuff, and then, oh, I don't have time for that. Men's ministry. No, your priority is wrong. Yeah, your priority is wrong there. You need to adjust those. Again, I'm not telling anybody who what their thing is, but, you know.
When somebody says they don't have time, that always irritates me because I've always felt like God gave every one of us 24 hours in a day. And how you use that 24 hours is up to you. But don't tell me you don't have time, because you got the same time I've got.
It's priority. It's what your priority. It's what your priority. And again, I don't know individuals, peoples, and that's not my job. But you do need to find that that balance, where you find that ministry that God has made you for. Because the problem is, you're specially made for it. Your gifts, again, your talents, your things, and the rest of us can't do it as well. And if you don't do it, then might not get done, you know. And that's not good. So, you know, and ministry is really, has been really, I mean, when I do it, I almost get more out of it. You know, it's really great. Because when you're doing ministry, you quickly realize you're completely incapable of accomplishing it. And that's really good for you. Because that pushes you to lean on Jesus. Because all the goals of ministry, for people to be saved, for people to grow in their faith, you can't do that. That's all the work of the Spirit. So it's really good for you to do ministry and struggle. Because it reminds you, you know, who's in charge, and reminds you just to do the best you can and don't worry about the results. It's really great, you know. And if you shared the gospel with that person, you were successful. If they got saved or not saved, that's not really up to you. But you did your job, and you shared the gospel. And you keep doing that, and you keep being kind to them. That's what you're supposed to do. You don't control their heart. Right? Noah was very successful, right? Nobody listened to him. Nobody listened to him, right? But he was still successful. He did what God wanted him to do, right? Because that's what we're called to do.
I think there needs to be, you said too, there's a balance, because we probably all know people that have a hard time saying no to certain things asked of them. And it can be good things in the church or whatever.
Right.
They're neglecting their own family.
Yeah, right.
And so
no, you don't want to do that.
End up in a divorce or whatever.
Right, that's the previous verse. If not, yeah, the previous verse, you're right, not neglect, you know. And, you know, sadly, there's a number of pastors that fall into that trap.
Yeah.
You know, they feel like their job is so important, they don't spend any time with their family because they're out doing, you know.
Yeah,
so
sure.
You're right. We all got to find that balance. Again, the previous verse, you know, you can't neglect your own family to go, you know, although you should have a ministry and be really involved in it.
We attended a church in Abilene when I was in school, and the pastor resigned. Midstream, I mean, just out of the blue from the congregation's perspective, he finished his sermon and called his wife up there and announced he's resigning because he's neglected his wife.
Wow.
And the dude was like my age, like, whoa. And it was like effective now.
Yeah,
but I don't know how big a fence he, I don't know what
the, yeah.
They kept it all secret, which is appropriate, but
yeah.
Good grief, it's
shocking. Crazy. Yeah,
but admirable.
Jerry has another really cool sentence, I think, in here where he says, true goodness does not look to the recipients, nor even to the results of its deeds for its reward. It looks to God alone, finding his smile of approval. That's really, you know, that's really good. You can be free of whatever the result is. And he points out that what a lot of people need, almost anybody can provide, and what a lot of people need is just somebody to listen. You know, which is not that hard, you know, just kind of empathetically listening and inviting, showing somebody they have value, right? I think that's connected back to the verse about don't become weary. Again, you become weary in doing good when your focus is on the wrong thing. People aren't thanking you, or you're not getting recognition, or you're not getting feel goodies or whatever. Whereas if your focus is on the right area, you know, following Jesus, then you gain continuous strength.
So the weariness is born out of the sin that you're having. Like,
the,
you're not,
the misfocus.
You're not,
yeah, the misfocus,
yeah,
I think.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we have a passage towards the end, this big one. I'm sure that everybody's familiar with this passage, right? Talking about the sheep and the goats. Remember who has that one? In Matthew. I'm going to look at it.
The Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him. Then he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. And then the king will say to those on his right, come, you are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, you clothed me. I was sick, you visited me. I was in prison, you came to me. Mm-hmm. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, thirsty, and give you something to drink? And when did we see you? Did we see a stranger and invite you in, or naked and clothed you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? The king will answer and say to them, truly, I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will also say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you didn't invite me in. Naked, you didn't clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you didn't visit. Then they themselves also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? And he will answer them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. These will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Okay. Pretty familiar passage. Okay, first rule of interpretation is always context, right? A lot of people read this quickly, and they assume what's taught by, well, most worldviews, right? That what's being said here is Jesus said, oh, good people, you're coming with me to heaven. Naughty people, you're going to the bad place. Right? They think it's all about, salvation is all about doing good stuff, okay? That's, of course, the rest of the Bible. It's clearly not the case. But even in here, you can kind of see some hints. Like when Jesus is talking to the sheep, what does he say? He says, "You who are blessed by my Father." And he says, "Take your inheritance." Did you earn the inheritance? He said, "That was prepared for you since the foundation of the world." Were you around at the foundation of the world? So even in that, you can see, right, that the salvation is from God, not you. They're a sheep because, right, Jesus planned it before the foundation of the world. Okay, so it's not, this isn't works-based salvation is what I'm saying. This is not saying do good stuff and get to heaven, be naughty and go to hell. That's not, that's what people commonly think. That's not what's going on here. What's going on here is, the context of this is Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven. He has multiple stories about the kingdom of heaven, and each story about the kingdom of heaven, he's saying, what is it like? And what are people who are in the kingdom of heaven like? And he's saying what people in the kingdom of heaven are like is they do good. Right? So good works are not the cause of salvation. Good works are the result of salvation. The train's the other way. You know, once you really accept Jesus, right? Once you really know who he is and what he did for you, don't you want to do good things for people, right? I mean, once it really penetrates, you did that for me, you know, King of heaven did that for me, right? Then you're transformed and you do the good, right? But you're not earning anything. Nobody earns it. That's actually offensive to try to earn it. You don't earn it. You don't have to earn it. That's the beauty. So he's not teaching that, right? He's just teaching that we're known by the good that we do, right? And the end of the chapter are kind of the high points that Jerry points out. He has four. So one, again, considering who you are, especially, you know, uniquely, things about you, it's a special trust from God. So you can serve others in a lot of unique ways that other people can't serve others. And that's why all of us should be serving others. And that's the way we walk. It should be every day the way we walk. When you go to the grocery store, right? I like to make my list and get my tasks done. But you know, God's teaching me, no, when you go to the grocery store, you might get a chance to be kind to somebody. And then later, maybe share the gospel with them. And that's actually way more important than just getting the stuff done. And he talks about, you know, you have to accept the cost. Right? It is going to cost you. Right? And then acknowledge that, again, you need God to work through you when you're loving your enemies or when you're serving difficult people or even when you're serving normal people, you know, that you don't become weary because your source, if you're connected to Jesus, you will not run out of strength. You will not run out of kindness and goodness because he's an infinite source of that. If you're doing it yourself, you're going to get tired of it because there's not that much of it in there. Right? So I think it's a really pretty thoughtful chapter. Pretty good, you know. When you look at the title, you're like, kindness, goodness. Yeah, okay, I know about that. Right? But he really got, I think he really got a lot out of it, you know. Or at least, I got a lot out of it. Pretty thoughtful. Pretty good stuff there. Another thing I thought about when I was looking at this is the fact that you live out of your identity, right? People live out of their identity. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if your identity is, here's Paul's talking, you know, about, you know, the love of guys, the love of Christ, how incredible it is. You know, once you really start to grasp that, that becomes your identity, mm-hmm. then you don't get tired of doing good things. You don't run out of energy, right? I mean, occasionally you're going to stumble, of course, because that's what we do. But this connectedness to him, that's your identity. That identity cannot be taken away. If you get fired, if people mean to you or reject you or betray you or whatever, you can't lose that identity. It can't be taken away, you know. So, pretty remarkable. All right, I'll stop there.